Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
If it's Monday, Washington braces for a series of dramatic showdowns and standoffs, potentially beginning tonight, as Kevin McCarthy takes the reins as Speaker of the House after granting sweeping new powers to the most conservative wing of his caucus. Plus, trade disputes, drug trafficking, and a growing humanitarian crisis. President Biden set to meet with the president of Mexico after witnessing the emergency at the U.S. southern border firsthand for the first time as president. An insurrection in Brazil with echoes of January 6th. Thousands of rioters stormed Brazil's Congress, its Supreme Court, and the presidential offices there after Brazil's former president pushed baseless claims of a rigged election. Hello to you and welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Peter Alexander. After 15 ballots, 4 days of drama and wheeling and dealing, California's Kevin McCarthy is now getting ready to gavel in the House for the first time since becoming Speaker. In roughly an hour from right now, McCarthy and the rest of the House Republican Conference will have to deal with the cost of that deal making. The House will soon gather to vote on the rules package for this, the 118th Congress. It'll essentially codify the deal that McCarthy made to get the speakership that cedes huge swaths of power to the House Freedom Caucus and to other ultra-conservatives within the party. The concessions McCarthy made include the following, that any one Republican member will be able to call for a vote to try to oust him as speaker at any time. A new select committee will be established with power to probe the Justice Department's active investigations at a moment's notice. They can do that. The power to probe the Justice Department's active investigations where federal prosecutors are weighing an indictment against former President Trump. And among the other concessions, more Freedom Caucus members will get spots on those key committees, and new restrictions will be implemented on what bills can and cannot be debated. Those changes are expected to create chaos at some key moments later this year. First, when Congress needs to avoid a government default this summer, and then when it needs to avoid a government shutdown later in the fall. Already, some of the more moderate members of the House Republican Caucus are warning that the concessions McCarthy made will lead to problems and potentially cost them with voters back home.
I don't want to see us every 2 months be in lockdown. This isn't the parliament. I mean, the American public are counting on House Republicans to be the one savior in this all. If we can't get this right, it's going to be a nightmare after nightmare.
I represent a purple district. I have to represent Republicans, Democrats, and independents. I want to know that the positions that I have are going to have a voice. It will have weight in the conference.
The concessions that McCarthy made mean the House Freedom Caucus will loom over every move he makes as speaker. As a first step to potentially unify his conference, House Republicans are going to do what they've been doing for a generation to help them come together, investigate the Democratic president. Here's the incoming Oversight Committee Chairman, Republican James Comer, on Meet the Press, previewing his committee's investigation into Hunter Biden.
Let me be clear. We're not investigating Hunter Biden. We're investigating Joe Biden. This isn't political. We want to know, was the president truthful when he said he didn't have any knowledge or involvement of his family's shady business dealings? And once we determine that, we'll move on.
Joining me now to help us out from Capitol Hill is NBC's Sahil Kapoor and Punch Bowl News co-founder and NBC News contributor Jake Sherman. First time seeing both of you this new year. Happy New Year, gentlemen. Sahil, let's start with you if we can. What are we expecting when the House gavels in just a matter of minutes from now?
Well, Peter, the big order of business this evening for the House is to vote on that rules package. It's more than 50 pages. It includes a host of concessions made to the House Freedom Caucus that Kevin McCarthy did to become Speaker McCarthy. That includes, as you mentioned, the motion to vacate the chair. It includes various other restrictions in the budgetary process that make it harder to raise taxes, that requires a three-fifths majority, and makes it harder to raise spending by creating points of order on that. And it constrains the House's options in terms of raising the debt limit. This is a big, big fight that's coming down the pike as conservative members of the Republican caucus insist on strings attached to it, strings that may not be able to pass the Democratic Senate or be signed into law by President Biden. So this evening, the House has to pass that rules package, codify these concessions that Kevin McCarthy has made, and get moving in terms of going forward as a caucus and legislating. There are also commitments that McCarthy has made to vote on seven bills that conservatives wanted. It's not clear any of them can pass the Senate and become law. But this is the big contrast we're looking forward. And finally, Peter, it's not clear that at this moment there's only one definitive no in terms of the House rules package. That is Tony Gonzalez of Texas. Nancy Mace has said she is okay with the rules package itself, but has raised concerns about what she calls backroom deals that McCarthy made with conservative members that she wants some answers on, Peter.
Well, that's the real question, right? We don't know some of the things to which he agreed. Let me ask you, Jake, what I think is sort of the fundamental question that we're going to witness over the course of this week and the months, weeks, who knows how long ahead, which is Kevin McCarthy going to be leading this caucus, or is the caucus going to be leading Kevin McCarthy?
Probably a combination of the two, Peter. I think McCarthy envisions a more bottom-up style, or at least that's what he says. Now, it's easy to say that when you've given away all your power. He had to. He had no other choice if he wanted to become Speaker than to seriously, devolve his power and disperse it across the conference. And I think to a certain degree, he's going to be the I think it's a little bit too much to say he's the Speaker in name only, or he's in a straitjacket, as Matt Gaetz said. But he, as Sahil said, he's definitely seriously restricted as to what he could do and what he will have the capability to do, even on more pedestrian things. Like if they have a bill that they want to bring up immediately, a piece of legislation that they think they need to pass immediately, they can't do that. They've committed to 72 hours before they could bring it up. So a host of changes that do weaken the speakership. There's no doubt about that.
So I guess in simple terms, then, the question is the drama that we witnessed over the course of much of last week going to be the norm, Jake, going forward?
Yes. Yes, especially in a take the kind of the bull case of this, right? A 222 seat majority, as we saw the last 2 years when Democrats had that, is very tight. I mean, there's no way around that. It's very difficult to manage. And I would say that House Republicans are more cleaved and more ideologically diverse, to put it kindly, than Democrats are. I mean, you have just a wide range of ideological makeups in the conference. So yes, it's going to be very difficult to manage for McCarthy and for the rest of the leadership.
Sahil, where are the places that we should be looking for possible bipartisanship? Do any of those windows exist here? Is there any potential for Democrats to work together with the Republicans?
It's hard to see, Peter. I think the one issue where Republicans legitimately have an ability, maybe not so much for, maybe a little bit for bipartisanship, but also to put pressure on Democrats in the Senate, is the issue of immigration. We have seen over the last year or year and a half that vulnerable Senate Democrats, from swing states, are nervous about anger regarding the border. They do see the issue as a mess. We saw senators like Mark Kelly last cycle breaking with President Biden, even Senator Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire doing that. So this immigration and the border is an issue where Republicans will have the ability to put pressure on Democrats, but they also have bills on abortion, which Democrats are not going to want to touch in the Senate. They're also trying to repeal portions of the Inflation Reduction Act, which conservative members of the House are very keen on doing, but that aren't going to get through the Democratic Senate. So I think the question is less what areas bipartisanship is available on than it is how will the House and the Senate do things that they must do, like fund the government and ensure that the U.S. government can keep paying its bills. Those are the big, that's the million-dollar question, I think, for this year in terms of legislation, Peter.
Jake, last and final one to you. Obviously, the goal of funding the government and avoiding a government shutdown being high on the list of priorities. But what is, after this Rules Committee votes that we're waiting to see, what is the sort of first flashpoint to keep an eye on?
Those are the two big ones. I mean, you're going to see a lot of drama around these abortion votes, which Nancy Mace kind of alluded to in that clip that you showed, because there are people, more people than probably ever in recent memory, or at least more powerful in a narrow majority. There are a lot of people from purple and from blue districts that don't want to vote to severely curtail abortion rights or anything of that nature. So those kinds of votes where McCarthy feels like he needs to throw meat to his red base is going to come into the reality that actually their majority was made in places like New York State and in Charleston, South Carolina, where it's a little bit more difficult to vote for those things.
And we should note, as we're talking to you gentlemen, we got some breaking news into us that the Congresswoman Nancy Mace will be a yes on the rules vote that's coming up just a short time from now. So she wanted to see what was decided behind closed doors. It sounds like she must be satisfied enough to vote in favor of the rules as they have been agreed to. Sahil and Jake, we appreciate it, gentlemen. Thanks for making time to talk to us. As we said, among the concessions Kevin McCarthy needed to make to secure the speaker's gavel was an agreement to establish a select committee to investigate what far-right Republicans call the weaponization of the federal government. Congressman Jim Jordan, the likely new chair of the Judiciary Committee, is poised to lead this new select committee. And while we do not know the details, including who will be a part of the committee, what will be its scope? It'll likely include investigating a number of Justice Department investigations, including ones into former President Trump. And we're joined now by Chuck Rosenberg, a former U.S. attorney, former senior FBI official, now fortunately for us, an NBC News legal analyst. Chuck, you know the DOJ inside and out. What is the thinking there about the creation of this select committee that in simple terms is an effort to investigate the investigators?
Right. So, you know, on one hand, Peter, it's just a political act and the professionals at the Department of Justice aren't going to pay much attention to it. They have work to do, important work to do, and they're going to do it. On the other hand, it could muck things up a little bit for the Department of Justice. I mean, worst case scenario, the committee starts granting immunity to people that the Department of Justice would otherwise prosecute and gets their testimony under oath pursuant to that immunity. And that could make life a little more difficult for prosecutors and agents. But by and large, I think it's a sideshow. And if I were a prosecutor, I would keep my head down and do my work.
So does the committee have the power to probe ongoing investigations? You kind of alluded to the potential mess they could create here as a sideshow, as you describe it. But can they probe these ongoing investigations?
They can probe whatever they want. I mean, Congress has, broad plenary oversight authority. But that doesn't mean the Department of Justice is going to give the Congress everything it wants. I mean, just think about the last 5 years, really the Trump administration years. The House didn't get everything it wanted from the administration. The administration claimed executive privilege on many documents, refused to cooperate in some instances. Well, now roles are reversed. A Democrat is president and the Republicans control the House. And I don't imagine that the executive branch, which includes the Justice Department, Peter, is going to give everything to the Congress that the Congress wants.
Let me ask you a little bit about what's been going on in Georgia today. After roughly a year, the Fulton County Special Grand Jury has wrapped up its investigation into the former President Trump's attempts to overturn Georgia's 2020 presidential election results. Walk us through, Chuck, what happens now? Can you give us a sense of when we'll find out the details, whether there are any indictments here, and what we should make of what we've now seen with the conclusion of this investigation there?
Absolutely. So first, a little bit of context. Georgia uses a special grand jury occasionally, rarely, as an investigative tool for prosecutors. There was one convened in Fulton County, Georgia, at the request of the district attorney down there. And that special grand jury has now concluded its work. But it's heard from many, many witnesses and reviewed, thousands of documents. And all of that is now available to the prosecutor. This special grand jury, now dissolved, can only make a recommendation as to charges, can't actually charge anybody with anything. But the prosecutor can take its recommendations and its work, which she oversaw, and move it to a regular grand jury. And if she wants to seek indictments, Peter, she can do that through a regular grand jury. Will that happen? Well, we don't know. We do know that in the next 2 weeks or so, the chief judge for that jurisdiction is going to make a decision about whether or not to make the special grand jury's report public. Sometime after that, I imagine the district attorney will decide whether to ask a regular grand jury to indict.
So, Chuck, if you're representing Donald Trump here, which I know you're not, are you more concerned about the Justice Department's investigation or the investigation that's coming out of Fulton County right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned about both, Peter. I'm not sure I could order them for you. But look, if you're the subject of a criminal investigation, state or federal, that's a bad day. Mm. And we know that he's the subject of numerous investigations. So I don't want to pick one over the other. It might be the case that Georgia is a little bit further down the road and may move more quickly. And so if you're a defense attorney for Mr. Trump, maybe that's where you're sort of focused right now. But he has problems in different jurisdictions and with different sovereigns, federal and state.
Yeah, by that standard, he's had a lot of bad days recently. Chuck Rosenberg, we appreciate your expertise and your time. Thank you very much. Coming up right here, much more on Kevin McCarthy's many concessions and the chaos that they could create in Washington. Our panel is next. Plus, President Biden faces the president of Mexico as those two countries face an emergency at the southern border. I'm going to speak to one of the Democrats who has been outspoken in his criticism of President Biden and the Biden administration's border policies. You're watching Meet the Press now.
Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed at home in your Keurig coffee maker with Dunkin' cold K-Cup pods. Just brew it hot over ice and enjoy flavor that's crafted to serve cold. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
As soon as we get the committee populated, our first committee hearing will be on the COVID funds. You know, we spent trillions of dollars in the name of COVID. There's not been a single hearing to oversee those funds during the entire COVID pandemic.
Welcome back. That was the incoming. James Comer, so you say incoming, House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer this morning saying that his committee's first probe will kick into gear soon. NBC reports that key committees expect to have their new members in place by the end of the week. And in some cases, hearings could start as soon as the end of this month with investigations into a number of conservative priorities, among them the origins of COVID-19, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the business dealings of President Biden's son Hunter. The bottom line, conservatives in the House are not wasting any time in taking their new powers for a spin. And joining me now is our panel, Jeff Mason, Reuters White House correspondent, Simone Sanders Townsend, the former spokesperson to Vice President Harris and host of Simone on MSNBC, and Doug High, Republican strategist and former communications director at the RNC. Doug, let's get to you out of the gates right now. You're watching your party, the Republicans. The question after the drama of last week is how they begin to govern. The first test, I guess, will be what happens as it relates to the Rules Committee's votes today and all the sort of concessions that Kevin McCarthy agreed to behind closed doors.
Well, a slight correction. They did waste some time. All last week was wasted. They could have hit the ground running if they had gotten this done in one vote or even two or three, and we wouldn't have had to be up till past midnight on Friday night and Saturday morning.
2 a.m.
Well, you stayed up later than I did. So they're going to hit the ground running as best they can. It starts with the rules package, which is what happens every Congress. Obviously, there are different rules every 2 years. And this is going to be a test to see how Republicans can govern and if they can govern. And if this passes in one vote, because like voting for speaker, if you don't pass the rule in one, you've got to change the rules and do two, three, four. We don't know. If they pass this early, it shows, okay, they can organize, they can be together, because Republicans have problems. There'll be attendance issues on Fridays and Thursdays as members leave town. And there's no proxy voting, so they don't have that crutch to depend on that Democrats did for 2 years.
And Jeff, as we watch this right now, obviously keep a close eye on the House moderates, those Republicans there, to see what they make of the Freedom Caucus's new powers and how they hope to wield those going forward right now. We just heard that Nancy Mace has said that she is a yes on rules, but there are a lot of Republicans right down closer to the middle who are like, well, wait, what is this deal about? This isn't the way we agreed we would do things.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the last week was all about the far-right
further right anyway, Republicans, this week and the coming weeks may be about the moderates and saying, look, we didn't sign up for this. This is not what we want. And we actually have a pretty important set of votes here, too. And that's part of Kevin McCarthy's challenge in general.
Simone, how soon before Kevin McCarthy sees the consequences of his concessions?
I mean, I think he'll start to feel them almost immediately. And he already has. The entirety of the conversation is about, that we just had, is about, well, what are the moderates going to do? He has to go and do the hand gliding and the checking, and his team has to do the checking on people who should be with him on, to be very clear, there shouldn't be all this back and forth on a rules package. These are things that are usually very procedural, electing the speaker, the rules package that the American people don't usually wade in the conversation on, that have now burst out into the open, that have become unnecessary struggles, if you will. And I think this is indicative of the kind of governor we're going to see from this Republican caucus.
You said they take the ball and start running, but any one of these guys could have a motion to vacate this thing. I mean, we could see this happening left and right if they don't get what they want on day one. Doesn't that handcuff this guy? As someone wrote, I thought, pretty well aptly about this, they said that Kevin McCarthy may have won the speakership, but he gave away the House.
Right. Look, it doesn't handcuff him, but clearly handcuffs are on the wall and could be pulled out. The expectation right now is that nobody would do this anytime soon. But again, that's there. And these are rules that existed in the past. It's typically the standard had been anybody can make a motion to vacate the chair. But the reality we've seen over the past 10 years as the Republican Party has changed is people are a lot more willing to do so. So if there comes a crisis point, we won't see this next week or the right. week after. If there becomes a crisis point, the House will stop and they'll vote on that. That's a challenge.
Simone, where should Democrats help Republicans? Is there any place where these two are going to do anything together?
I think they have to do something as it relates to the economy. They need to keep pushing the ball forward on that. Look, I don't
Doesn't
know about
like
y'all,
the
but
really
I go to the grocery store, Peter, eggs about $8, $9, depending on where you are going.
You come to my Trader Joe's, we can do it cheaper than that.
Oh, well,
but that's
see,
my
I've
journey.
Been at the Safeway. That's my problem. So they have to do something about the economy. I think the reality is, though, that there are diverging views of how to address that. This conversation comes into talking about spending and whatnot. Really, the only way to cut the drastic cuts that a number of these very conservative Republicans in the House are talking about is to cut Medicare and Social Security. Now, that is something that is just not popular with a very strong voting bloc. I'm talking about anybody over the age of like 55. So that is the kind of conversations I think that people are having right now. Democrats on their own, though, they have to be willing to say they've done something and not just be obstructionist to a Republican agenda. So that is why you see President Biden going out there. He is going to be cutting a lot of more ribbons. There are a lot more Brent Spence bridges across the country that I think we're going to see him going to.
Well, let me ask you about that, Jeff. You and I work at the White House or cover the White House. We have small little hovels in the back corner there. It does seem like President Biden right out of the gates right now in 2023 is focused on 2024. The announcement he made as it relates to Title 42 mm-hmm. on immigration obviously upset a lot of immigration advocates and some Democrats. Republicans will obviously always be upset with the president as it relates to this topic. Is that what the tact is right now to try to tack toward the middle as it heads toward the next year?
Couple things. One, I think on the immigration piece that you rightly mentioned, I think he was just trying to clear the decks there. Like, he knew it. Eventually he had to address that issue. He had to go to the border. It's going to be a talking point, just as it has been for Republicans for the last 2 years. It will be if he's on a debate stage with a Republican opponent. As for in the rest of his sort of look at 2024, I think part of what, like, the trip last week where he met with McConnell to look at that bridge was kind of a blueprint for the year. He wants to show that he can work with Republicans who want to work with him. And both sides, to get to Simone's point earlier, have to show that they can govern. Biden's argument will be, I've shown it. And this is what I've gotten done. The Republicans in the House will have to see if they can meet that as well.
It was a heck of a split screen, right? Watching the chaos that we're seeing on the Hill. And there's Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden basically shaking hands and celebrating along the bridge between Kentucky and Ohio. Let me ask you, as we talk about immigration, Simone, quickly. The vice president was tasked early on. She's had a tough plate. But one of the challenges that was put on her plate was this topic of migration that she was supposed to oversee. I know the VP's office would always say the topic was not the border. It was the topic of migration.
The root causes of migration. I believe I used to be that spokesperson.
I was going to say, I think that language came
Sounds
from you
familiar.
As we spoke before. But has she lived up to the responsibility that was tasked to her, the vice president, on this topic as we focus on immigration?
I think yes, but the problem is that this is such a complicated issue, right? When American people talk about immigration, they are really talking about what they see at the United States-Mexico border. And when you see an influx of individuals, when you talk to folks who live in these border towns, mayors from the border towns, it is difficult. And I think that it is important the administration recognizes that. And part of President Biden's visit, I think, was to demonstrate that he is gone to see firsthand what folks are working with. The work that the vice president has done since I have left that office has really focused a lot around diplomacy with Lopez Obrador, the president of Guatemala, yeah. but also private sector. And so the amount of money and commitments that the vice president and her team have gotten private sector companies to invest in Central North America is critically important because an economic infrastructure, an economic engine in those places will shore up things so folks don't want to leave home.
You worked at that. You worked at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. You know the way that they think over there right now. Obviously, the select committees could be looking into, they say, Joe Biden, not Hunter Biden, whatever it is, the Biden family broadly. How concerned is the White House, or should the White House be, about these high-profile investigations as they were in likely committee hearings?
I don't think that my former colleagues should allow the oversight, and I'm going to use quotes because this is a thumb to the nose of the founders of what real oversight is really supposed to be about. Allow this, you know, oversight to take over what they are focused on. But they do have to be vigilant and pay attention, because if not handled properly, it could really suck up all the air in the room. And so I would bet that they probably have a small task group that has been formed to focus on this very thing. A couple people, they've got a comms lead, somebody from legal, somebody who's working with folks on the Hill. And that is how they'll triangulate it. And this group of people will do that while the rest of the folks in the West Wing focus on the president's broader agenda.
Something they've been anticipating for a while now. Doug, is there a risk for Republicans of reaching too far?
Yes, I was talking to a colleague today about, we've seen new comments from Randy Weingarten saying, actually, we wanted to reopen the schools, which I would argue is not true. But if Republicans, as we're having the steering committee meeting right now for who will be the Ed and Workforce Committee chair, probably Virginia Fox from North Carolina, my member of Congress, actually, if Republicans are seen as making her somebody Republicans have vilified for 2 years now, I think deservedly so, if they make her sympathetic, if they're seen as not just asking her tough questions, but really going after her and screaming and yelling, as we've seen quite often happen, that runs a risk. And Republicans have to be careful of this. Ask questions, don't make speeches.
Yeah, and the other question is what Americans really want them to be focusing on right now. Likely not investigations on any side. They probably want to see their pocketbook issues probably be addressed
first. They want the eggs to go
eggs,
down.
No doubt, yeah. No doubt. We'll bring it to Trader Joe's this weekend. We can find a good deal together. Jeff, Simone, Doug, thank you so much. We turn now quickly to California. Earlier today, President Biden approved an emergency declaration authorizing federal aid to help respond to the deadly storms that are affecting so much of that state. My home state, the pictures have been awful. Today, 15 million people are under flood alerts with thousands urged to evacuate after a series of violent storms. These are parts of Santa Cruz County under evacuation right now as the San Lorenzo River overflows into the streets. At this hour, there are new immediate evacuation orders for parts of Santa Barbara County further south. The governor's office confirms there have been 12 storm-related deaths since the severe weather began late last month. They needed rain, but not all at once, the Californians are saying. More than 300,000 homes and businesses lost power this weekend, and more than 100,000 are in the dark still today. The Sacramento and Stockton school systems canceled classes because of the outages. All the storms are not over. California is bracing for more major episodes of high winds, heavy rain, and snow this week. The National Weather Service predicting 2 to 5 inches of rain to pummel the coast and more than 6 feet of snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Up next, border crisis and diplomacy. President Biden heading to Mexico City's National Palace for a meeting with President Lopez Obrador that's expected to focus on migration, drugs at the border, and a host of other challenges. The latest reporting from Mexico City, plus a one-on-one interview with a border state lawmaker. That is ahead. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. You're watching Meet the Press now. And President Biden is in Mexico right now, where he'll be participating in a meeting of North American leaders, affectionately known as the Three Amigos Summit. The president's going to join the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau tonight, kicking off a series of conversations over the next 2 days that are expected to focus on the current crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. President Biden visited the border for the first time of his presidency on the way to Mexico yesterday, as the migrant crisis there has reached critical levels, specifically in places like El Paso. President Biden meeting with local lawmakers and immigration enforcement during his visit, but notably, he did not meet face-to-face with any migrants Despite policies like Title 42 that can limit asylum claims and border crossings, hundreds of migrants are lining the streets of El Paso, sleeping there, overwhelming the city's shelter system and humanitarian infrastructure. NBC's Kristen Welker filed this report for us from El Paso earlier this afternoon.
Hi, Peter. Good afternoon to you. President Biden is in Mexico holding critical talks on a range of issues, but the most pressing issue is the crisis at the border here in El Paso, what's considered the epicenter. Migrants are finding all sorts of ways to get over or under this fence behind me. And when President Biden visited on Sunday, he came face to face with this crisis. He met with state and local officials. He also toured a migrant processing center. It was notable he was greeted by criticism on all sides. Republican Governor Greg Abbott greeted him on the airport tarmac with a letter, a list of demands, saying that this visit is 2 years too late. He's also getting criticism from humanitarian groups who are saying that his new immigration policy, which actually seeks to expand Title 42, that COVID-era policy that allows border officials to keep migrants out, is inhumane. Now, the president did not actually meet with migrants while he was on the ground. Two senior administration officials tell me that's because migrants had already been processed at that aid center before the president visited. Still, it's worth noting, just a short distance from where the president was, migrants lined the streets, including Maria Rodriguez, who told us about her harrowing journey from Venezuela, including hiding in a garbage truck for 5 days.
5 days in la basura.
En la basura.
5 days hiding in trash.
La basura, escondido en un container.
Rodriguez telling me she made that life-threatening journey with her children, with her nephew, because she just wants a better life for her family, for her children. And so many migrants with whom I spoke, Peter, had similar stories to tell. On the other hand, we spoke with residents of El Paso, one man telling me that he feels for the migrants. He wants to help them. At the same time, he doesn't believe that El Paso can support this surge at the border. Now, just underscoring the tensions, 6 migrants were arrested before the president arrived, opening up law enforcement to criticism that they were trying to sanitize this crisis ahead of the presidential visit. That is a criticism they forcefully deny. All of this, Peter, all of this will be front and center during the president's talks in Mexico over the next 2 days. Peter.
My colleague Kristen Welker, co-chief White House correspondent, reporting there. NBC's Mike Mammoli is in Mexico City ahead of the start of this summit. Mike, nice to see you there. What do we expect from President Biden's visit to Mexico for this Three Amigos summit? Obviously, the topic of migration and the issue at the border is going to be high on the list.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. I mean, it's been really interesting as you and I have been covering this administration for the last 23 months already. Immigration was, let's just say, not the highest priority as we've been tracking the other developments, the president pushing forward on his domestic agenda, other priorities, and of course, the situation in Ukraine. The White House has been fond of saying on day one, the president introduced that immigration bill, but then he largely delegated this issue to Vice President Kamala Harris in terms of the situation at the border. Now, as he's getting ready to start the second half of his first term, we are seeing this really multi-day series of events focused on immigration. The announcement, of course, at the White House on Thursday of his ramped up enforcement measures, but also those new legal pathways for migrants from specifically Haiti, Nicaragua, and Cuba, in addition to Venezuela. Then that visit to the border that Welker just laid out so well, and now these meetings in Mexico. And so what the White House has been trying to illustrate is, one, that this is a challenge that is beyond one president's ability to tackle here within the U.S. He needs Republicans in Congress to partner with him on meaningful legislation. But secondly, that this is a global challenge, and even more so a hemispheric challenge. The president, of course, hosted the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles a few months ago, multiple countries putting concrete commitments on the table for things that they would want to do. And this summit here with the Prime Minister of Canada and, of course, the President of Mexico is meant to build on those commitments to try to find additional ways they can deal with these root causes and try to manage this crisis together.
Of course, the U.S. and Canada with very different approaches as it relates to the topic of immigration. It'll also be interesting to watch the personal relationship between the Mexican president and President Biden. We'll keep a close eye. I know, Memo, you'll be there. Thanks, Mike, very much for your reporting. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar, who was with the president at the border yesterday and has been a vocal critic of how long it took for the White House to make this trip, is going to be with us here live next. But first, we do want to take a moment to remember veteran journalist Bernard Kalb. Bernard Kalb was a foreign correspondent for more than 30 years, spending time at the New York Times, at CBS, and of course, right here at NBC. During his tenure at NBC, Kalb appeared as a panelist on Meet the Press 6 times, twice alongside his brother, fellow journalist, and Meet the Press moderator, Marvin Kalb. After leaving NBC, Bernard Kalb became a spokesperson for the State Department during the Reagan administration, the first journalist who had covered the department to do so. Here he was in August of 82 during his third Meet the Press appearance, pressing the then Prime Minister of India.
Madam Prime Minister, given the record, the poor record of the use of Soviet military equipment in the war in Lebanon, particularly between the Israelis and the Syrians, is India having any second thought about its massive reliance on Soviet equipment in its own defense?
I wouldn't call it massive reliance. We are trying our very best to be self-reliant, which is not easy for us at this stage. And we began diversifying our defense purchases several years ago.
But the question is whether you have any second thoughts about the capability of Soviet equipment as
it's been. I'm not a military expert, but I'm told by our own defense people that they don't entirely agree with this assessment.
That was our Meet the Press Minute. Bernard Kalb died on Sunday. He was 100 years old. Welcome back. President Biden was joined at the border yesterday by members of Congress. And right now, a bipartisan group of senators are in El Paso, where they are currently holding a roundtable with local officials and are set to tour a migrant facility later this hour. With Democrats only holding a very slim majority in the Senate and following a week of Republican infighting in the House, it seems unlikely that this Congress will be able to pass any meaningful immigration reform. Joining me now is Congressman Henry Cuellar, who represents parts of the Rio Grande region of Texas and joined President Biden in El Paso yesterday. Congressman Cuellar, I appreciate your being here on Meet the Press. Now, as we noted, you were there at the border with the president yesterday. Does the president, after that visit, in your view, have a better understanding of the crisis that you've been talking about for so long? And what, if any, specific commitments did he make to you there?
You know, first of all, I think it was good for the P of policy and the P for politics. The P of policy is important because I think as a leader, you need to go down there, not only listen to the immigration activists, but you got to listen also to border communities, landowners, sheriffs, judges, mayors that are down there. You got to listen to them. And I think going down there provides them an opportunity to learn what happens at the border. Being 1,500 miles away is very different from, like myself, that we live there every single day. So for the P for policy, it was good. Politics, without a doubt, I think this is, including the policy that came out on Thursday, it's shifting him over to the center.
So what, if any, specific commitments did he make to you? Is anything going to change based on this visit that satisfies your needs?
Well, you know, first of all, the policy that he announced for about a month or so, I had been talking to Secretary Mayorkas about concepts. You know, you got to provide incentives for people to go in and do it the right way for asylum seekers. But at the same time, disincentives so they come in between ports like most people do.
And to be clear, this is the policy that the administration announced last week where they're going to let in an additional 30,000 migrants from places like Venezuela and Cuba and elsewhere each month, but they're also going to expedite the expulsion of individuals who come to this state, What specifically do you want from President Biden now? Based on this visit, you got him to the border. That's the first thing you wanted. So now what do you want to see?
Number one. Number two, make sure that he advocates for more resources to the men and women in blue and green. Most drugs, as you know, 94% of the meth will come through ports of entry. 91% of the meth come through ports of entry. The narrative that they come in through migrants is not true in between ports. So that technology and the canines and what we need, the personnel down there at the border is important. Because look, ports of entry have changed in so many ways. In the past, it was tourism and trade. Now it's a third dimension is asylum seekers. And that's why it's important. So the commitments that we talked about, or should I say the things that we talked about with the president, get more resources down there at the border.
President Biden did not notably meet with any migrants during this visit. The White House said that he went to a processing center. When he got there, there were no migrants there, or he would have been glad to meet with them. Was it a mistake for President Biden not to meet with any migrants on this visit?
Well, I think it was more important for him to show up at the border, which he did. He went to the port of entry. He went to the processing center. He went to the actual border.
So you're not concerned that he didn't speak with the migrants that are having these experiences?
No, I think what he did was talk to the workers, to the border communities, to the ones that feel this every single day. It would have been good if he would have been able to do that. It didn't happen. But I think the overall presence is a positive for the president and the administration.
President Biden said that the funding necessary to really make these things happen is now in the control of a Republican House, is in the control broadly of Congress. Do you have any belief system that this new Congress can accommodate those needs in terms of funding?
Well, I hope they can. I think what we saw last week was a preview of what I think the next 2 years are going to look like. I'm in line to become the ranking member for Homeland Appropriations. I'm waiting to see who the chairman will be. So hopefully it's somebody that can be bipartisan, that I can sit down and provide that funding for Homeland.
You talk about Homeland Appropriations. Let me ask you about Homeland Security broadly. Right now, the Tennessee Congressman Mark Green apparently has won the Homeland Security Committee gavel there. How concerned are you to have a member of the Freedom Caucus control that committee?
You know, a lot of us felt that Dan Crenshaw, the Republican from Texas, everybody thought he was going to run. Yeah, more moderate. Let's see how Mr. Green deals with us. I did notice that one of the things that I think was tweeted out, that he wants to put two permanent staffers at the border. I don't know exactly what they'll be doing down there, but it'll be interesting working with them. I hope we can find lines of communications.
Kevin McCarthy has teased the idea of impeaching the Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas. Is that something you support?
No, I don't. It doesn't move the ball forward. I want to look for practical solutions. Look, you know, there are times that we're going to disagree, and I have disagreed with the secretary. But again, it's, you don't impeach somebody for a disagreement on a policy. We need to find ways how we can secure the border and at the same time provide a legal pathway, orderly pathway for asylum seekers.
What specifically do you, Congressman, think you'll be able to work with Republicans on in this new Congress?
You know, I've talked to Congressman Tony Gonzalez, Senator Cornyn. Actually, he and I were texting yesterday before I took off with the president. So we're trying to find ways so we can address some of the issues. So there are some moderate Republicans like Senator Cornyn, Tony Gonzalez, and other folks that I think we can sit down. The question is, can the whole Republican caucus support some of the moderate ideas?
Yeah, and some of the policies obviously are causing a lot of headlines, I guess we'll say, including the announcement that we expect coming of a select committee to investigate the investigators, to go after the weaponization of the Justice Department, as Republicans describe it. Republicans have expressed, in hindsight, frustration that they didn't allow themselves to join the January 6th committee, that they say they effectively could have mucked it up from within. Should Democrats participate in the select committee that Kevin McCarthy and Republicans are likely to announce in the days ahead?
You know, the Republicans had their way. I mean, they had an opportunity to join. They didn't want to do
it. So should Democrats join this one?
You know, I'll leave it up to our leadership. I don't know.
Would you serve as a member if asked?
I will serve as a member of the Homeland Appropriations, Defense Appropriations.
The committee on which you serve right now.
That's correct.
Congressman Henry Cuellar, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Appreciate
you
making time
to
talk to us. We do have another update we want to give you right now. Some good news on the NFL player DeMar Hamlin's recovery. Did you hear this earlier today? Doctors in Cincinnati announced that the Bills safety had been released from the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. He's now continuing his recovery at a hospital back in Buffalo. Hamlin tweeted that he was happy to be back in Buffalo and that the staff at Buffalo General Hospital is making him feel right at home. Of course, it comes a week after Hamlin went into cardiac arrest after that hit during a Bills-Bengals game. He had his breathing tube removed last week and was able to talk with his teammates over FaceTime on Friday. For all the crummy headlines we have to report, that's one worth celebrating. Turning now to New York City, where thousands of nurses went on strike this morning, over 7,000 joining the picket line at two of the city's largest hospitals, Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan and Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. Both facilities are diverting ambulances and transferring patients to other hospitals. The strike comes after a weekend of negotiations as the New York State Nurses Association pushes for higher pay and more staffing in their first new contract since the COVID-19 pandemic began. Talks broke down between the union and hospital leaders overnight. And as of this afternoon, negotiations have not resumed. The conflict between the city's major hospitals and their nurses is part of a nationwide movement that has seen healthcare workers launch strikes across the nation. Still to come right here, chaos and unrest in Brazil. Thousands of Bolsonaro supporters protest election results and storm government buildings, and an extraordinary yet familiar attack on democracy. The latest on that. You're watching Meet the Press now.
Well, let's be clear. This was an obvious and clear attack on a democratic process, and we condemn it, of course. I will also say that, as I've said to the ambassador, Ambassador Bagley, that I'm very confident in her ability to represent the United States and to extend to President Lula all that we mean in terms of the work that we will do together as allies on some of the most important issues facing our world.
Welcome back to Meet the Press Now. That was, of course, Vice President Kamala Harris just minutes ago responding to yesterday's attack on Brazil's government building. Shortly, she swore in the new U.S. ambassador to Brazil. In an attack eerily reminiscent of January 6th in Washington, supporters of far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro stormed government buildings in the capital city of Brasilia to protest baseless claims of a rigged election. About 1,500 people have been detained for questioning in the wake of the attack, one of the most violent assaults on democracy since Brazil's military dictatorship ended nearly four decades ago. It all came 1 week after Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was sworn in as that country's president. Bolsonaro, meanwhile, is currently in the hospital, according to his wife, due to abdominal pain. She did not say where he has been hospitalized, but he's reportedly been seen in Florida recently. NBC News has not been able to confirm his latest whereabouts. Cecilia Tornaghi is the managing editor at America's Quarterly that covers politics and business in the Americas. She is joining us now. Cecilia, thanks for your time and your expertise on this topic. You say that there were warnings for days about what was going to happen just yesterday. Why weren't government officials more prepared there? Was this a function of a breakdown in security?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all, Peter. It's hard to say whether it was a break in security or it was a purposeful stand down from security forces. What we had was a plan that was described the Friday before, including a plan that was discussed with the Minister of Justice, Flavio Dino, and the local authorities, because, of course, the Brazilian law says that the local government of the federal district, the Brasilia is part of the capital, is actually in charge of security. So there was this meeting on Friday where they agreed how things were going to go down, where the federal government put some forces available for the local government to help, because it was known for weeks that they've been calling. For the last week, there have been messages everywhere calling people to go to Brasilia. So it wasn't a surprise at all that all these people were going to show up. And the plan was to close the access to this area where you see the Supreme Court, Congress, and the Presidential Palace. But of course, these plans didn't work, as we could see. But more than that, they were changed on Friday. And the Minister of Justice himself said that he only found out that the plans had changed on Saturday, that the plans had changed through the media. He was not informed.
Cecilia,
and one
hour before
the invasion, they said everything is calm.
I was just going to ask, why yesterday specifically, and what are you watching for in the days ahead as it relates to the threat of future protests like these?
Yesterday, I think there's a few things here. First, it's easier to get a lot of people on buses and chart them towards the Capitol on a Sunday when people don't have to work. There is financing of this movement, so a lot of people are actually paid to go as well, or at least had their tickets and everything helped. So over the weekend is easier. To do that before the inauguration or during the inauguration would have been much, much harder because security was much tighter. It was expected on December 12th, the day Lula was confirmed and received his diploma as president-elect, there were riots in Brasilia already, where people were calling a dress rehearsal, so to speak, when they burned buses and so on. So it was known that this was a risk. There, that is the reason why, until the inauguration day, there was really tight, much tighter security in Brasilia. So things were laxer. The president was trying to be president and helping it at another city, trying to talk to people who were affected by the rains. And this manifest, so to speak, the protesters were calling this for this specific Sunday, not only to storm Brasilia, but also to close refineries and fuel distribution centers across the country. That was the call. They wanted to halt the nation.
Cecilia, for obvious reasons, this was seemed eerily familiar to so many Americans. How much culpability do the far right American political figures, Donald Trump, have in yesterday's attack? Was that sort of, I don't know, the blueprint for what we witnessed?
I guess writing the playbook is probably the most logical link to culpability here. And of course, we had supporters of President Trump celebrating the what happened in Brasilia yesterday. So I think there is a concerted, it's kind of clear that it was a follow of what happened in the U.S. to a certain extent. But there has been this animosity that has been cultivated for the last 4 years against the Supreme Court and Congress. You got to remember, in the U.S., they stormed the Capitol. In Brasilia, they stormed the three centers of power, like if they were in storming the White House and the Supreme Court at the same time. So this animosity has been cultivated over the last 4 years when repeatedly, not only the election that was called fraudulent, but repeatedly the three powers have been called corrupt and inept and so on and so forth, and against the government by the previous administration. So this sort of solidified in this angry reaction right now. These people really believe that they own the country and that the democratic powers to be institutions are against them.
Cecilia Tornaghi, we appreciate your time, your perspective, and your expertise. Thank you for being with us this hour. That will do it for us right now. We'll have more Meet the Press Now at this time tomorrow. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.